Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm your sometime host, Baron Soka. I'm here with Larry Downes, my favorite author on tech policy. Larry is the author of numerous books. I first discovered Larry because of his book, The Laws of Disruption, written in 2010. Larry Downes, you've been a business management consultant. You went back to law school. You actually write from an understanding of both worlds, unlike many lawyers who write about business and business people who talk about law. What else have you done with your career?
That's a nice way of looking at my career. I mean, I look at the resume and I go, man, this guy couldn't hold a job for more than a year or two. So, I mean, most of my time in business was spent doing systems development, systems integration for, you know, large organizations. So I really think of myself principally as an engineer, and particularly, you know, computer science. I had a background in computer science before going into business. And that's really, you know, obviously I can't keep up with the technology like everybody else. But I at least have the foundational grounding that a lot of people don't seem to have.
So you know something about business and engineering, whereas I'm just a lawyer. So I'll try to just stick to the lawyer stuff today. So and your most recent books have been?
Well, the most recent book was in 2014. It was called Big Bang Disruption with my co-author, Paul Nunes. And that was pretty much strictly a business book. We were looking at how strategic planning has changed in a world where, you know, internet has shrunk the life cycle for businesses dramatically, and what companies, large and small, needed to do about that.
So you started your work back in the 90s with a book about unleashing the killer app.
That's right.
So what was that about?
So that was 1998, very well timed, although not by, you know, more by accident than by design. It was really sort of one of the first books to get published to say, this is what the internet means to traditional businesses. You know, there'd been some sort of books about the internet, but we were trying to look at how regular businesses that hadn't changed in a long time, that hadn't had major technological disruptions for a long time, how they were going to be affected. And, you know, it was the time before people, you know, it was sort of a time when people would say, oh, no one's ever going to buy a car on the internet. And stock brokers would say, well, our customers don't want to trade stocks online. They like calling us. And newspaper people were saying, oh, it's cute to print out, you know, the newspaper from your home. But of course, you know, you have to have the print because it smells so good. I mean, all these crazy things that people thought they were immune from the internet. Our book said you're not, and that kind of got the attention of a lot of corporate CEOs who suddenly thought, okay, I really have to pay attention now to the internet. So that was very fortuitous timing.
So 2010, your book takes that approach and tries to apply it to policy. So Big Bang Disruption, what is that and what does that mean for policymakers?
So the 2010 book was Laws of Disruption. We're talking about the 2014 book, which was Big Bang Disruption. So,
okay, well, there's a lot of disruption disrupting the conversation.
So that was unfortunate that I, you know, couldn't be more creative with my titles. But which one do you want to talk about?
Well, the 2010 book. So what's the connection here between the concept of disruption, which, you know, people in DC talk about a lot in policy circles. I'm not sure they fully understand what that means, but what do you see as the connection between that concept and an actual sound policymaking?
Right. So one of the things that we said in the very first chapter of the Killer App book back in 1998 was that the reason that the internet and sort of related technologies, exponential technologies, anything kind of driven by Moore's law, which now is pretty much everything, a reason that they were so disruptive is because they accelerated in their pace of change. And we said, you know, legal systems, social systems, business systems, they're all incremental. And in fact, they're designed to be incremental. Obviously, we don't want our law to change quickly. We want to be deliberative about law and policy. And because of that, because there's this acceleration on the one hand and a sort of constant speed on the other, there was going to be a growing gap between what technology was capable of doing and what our institutions were capable of absorbing. And we kind of left it at that in 1998, but I came back to that in 2010 in the Laws of Disruption. I said, well, you know, we've now seen many, many conflicts, what I referred to as the accident-prone intersection of law and technology. We'd already seen lots of conflicts with copyright and patent and privacy and jurisdiction and just the law of software itself and so on. And so that book was sort of looking at what I thought were 9 or 10 of the the most likely areas of future conflict between law and technology, and obviously try to put my spin on what should lawmakers, policymakers, regulators, what should they do given this inevitable conflict?
And in general, what's your advice?
Do nothing. The bottom line was, because of that accelerating pace, you know, you can't speed up legal institutions. Again, I don't think you want to speed up legal institutions too much because we like deliberative government. It's there for times of non-crisis. It works very well, but in times of crisis,
what a cute thing for someone from outside of DC to say on your visit to our
your lovely,
squalid little city,
your lovely town. You're doing a great job. Keep it up. You know, I went back to Thomas Kuhn and this idea of paradigm shift. And one of the things that
structures of scientific revolution.
Yeah, structures of scientific revolution. One of the things that Kuhn said is he looked at all the major shifts in scientific thinking, and what you found was that when a radical new idea that, let's say, you know, the Earth revolves around the sun, as one of his examples, you can't just kind of tell the old scientists to change their thinking. They've grown up and they've spent their whole careers in what he called normal science, which is kind of incremental improvements to the old theory. And when the new theory comes along, it's going to take, as Kuhn said, you know, even once it's clear that the new theory is better than the old theory, it's going to take 10 to 20 years before it becomes the dogma of whatever the field is. And why 10 to 20 years? Because that's how long it takes for the existing incumbent, you know, scientists and tenured faculty to either retire or die, because they're not going to change, even when they have no more arguments left. And so what I said was, you know, the law is sort of very similar here. It's going to, you know, these changes are going to happen. Digital distribution of content is going to completely challenge the way in which we think about copyright, particularly copyright enforcement. How do you stop copyright infringement? Well, in the old days, you knew where the people had their printing presses and you knew how they distributed because there was no way to hide that. But in an age where costs were zero for content distribution and for even for many forms of content creation, those enforcement mechanisms weren't going to work. So what should policymakers do? Well, they were not going to be able to quickly enough respond with changes to law. And so really what they should do is let the technology work itself out. So rather just respond to every crisis. Let's say, you know, Napster shows up and of course, you know, it throws into complete chaos the entire music industry. Well, you know, if you passed the law right away, you would probably get it wrong. It would stay on the books forever and it would lead to long-term unexpected and negative consequences. Better to let it play itself out. In the end, of course, you know, copyright ultimately sort of worked in that case, even in its kind of imperfect form. But of course, what it really did was then to establish the parameters of what a working business model might be for digital music. And so not surprisingly, it wasn't companies, you know, startups like Napster who figured it out ultimately. But learning from that example, Apple came out with the iTunes Store and ultimately came up with a way of doing digital music that was both legal and profitable.
Although even that, let's just note, didn't really last all that long because now people use services like Spotify where they subscribe.
Well, of course, that's a great example because the technology changed. So again, if you had made the law and said, oh, okay, the new law is, you know, you have to buy digital copies, they have to charge this much for them, they have to last this long, well, you would have preempted possibly the idea of streaming services, which wouldn't have been possible then because the technology wasn't good enough, the networks weren't fast enough, all the, you know, relevant software didn't exist. If you had legislated prematurely, you might have foreclosed a future innovation that's even better than the one you were trying to protect.
So that's 2010.
That's 2010.
Laws of Disruption. And then Big Bang Disruption. What's the difference?
So the 2014 book really was kind of coming back more to the themes of the earlier book of the Killer App book and saying, what are the implications for business strategy of this condensed timeline, this condensed life cycle for businesses? And what we said was, you know, we went back to the 1950s, a sociologist named Everett Rogers wrote some very influential works on how disruptive innovations are adopted in societies. And he looked at several of them and he said, you know, there's kind of this bell curve shape to new technology adoption. You have early adopters, you have kind of the majority, which is the hump of the bell curve, and then you have laggards at the end. And he said, this is very consistent. Now, this work was taken up in the 1990s by people like Clayton Christensen and Jeffrey Moore saying, you know, this is a model that you should use if you're a venture capitalist or if you're a technologist, how you should think about marketing your products. Well, you want to market differently to those different segments and at different times. How you should think about strategy. In Christensen's example, if you're an incumbent and you see a radical new technology enter your field, let's say, you know, you make steam-driven excavators and you see hydraulics coming into place, this created what he called the innovator's dilemma, where you didn't want to cannibalize your own business, but you also didn't want to ultimately be surpassed by better and cheaper technology. And what he said was, well, these new technologies, when they show up, let's say hydraulics, they're worse and more expensive. And so you don't have to do anything right away except watch them, but you have to be ready when the time comes to make the shift if you want to survive. Our observation of Big Bang Disruption was the time you have to make that shift has gotten shorter and shorter all the time.
So, okay, I read The Innovator's Dilemma, Clayton Christensen's book, in college. That book, along with Virginia Pistrell's book, The Future and Its Enemies, were the books that really set me to doing what I do today. And Tech Freedom is really dedicated to those ideas, what Virginia calls dynamism.
At the end of the podcast, folks, the Tech Freedom is shutting down because Clayton Christensen's work is no longer valid.
Now, this is my question, exactly what I was going to ask. So I understand you to agree with him in part and disagree in part. Which parts?
So we agree that indeed innovators are faced with a dilemma when they have a disruptive technology enter their field, whatever the industry is. When some core technology is about to be changed, that does create a dilemma where on the one hand, you want to adopt it, you understand it's the future, but on the other hand, you've got a business to run, you need, you know, operating revenue in order to continue doing anything. And so you're stuck, let's say you're Kodak, you see the future is digital photography, but you're in the print photography business. Your whole world is built around that. Where we differ from Christensen is pretty much how much time you have to think about it. He said, you know, you got lots of time because he said those new technologies, digital photography, are going to enter the market. And when they do, they're going to be worse quality and they're going to be more expensive. And so only early adopters, only kind of, you know, pioneers or experimental consumers are going to play with them. You don't have to do anything right away, but you have this nice long lead time where you can kind of set up a small experiment of your own, as Skunk Works, he called it, and that you got all this time before the change comes. Well, what we said was we've had enough generations now of Moore's Law and this accelerating entry of new, cheaper, faster, better computing power such that now the amount of time you have once that new disruptor enters your market is zero. If you weren't watching it before it was ready for prime time, when it enters the market, it's not worse and more expensive. It's actually better and cheaper right from the beginning. And the first example we gave of this was GPS on a smartphone. So, you know, you used to have, maybe you don't remember this, but back in the Stone Ages of, let's say, you know, the early 2000s, you'd have a standalone GPS device in your car that you got from Garmin or Magellan or TomTom that just did that, that just did GPS, you know, directions and so on. And then one day, literally one day, Google and then Apple introduce an app for the smartphone, which of course didn't exist before, but now everybody had one. And they said, oh, here's an app. It's Maps and it has navigation and it costs exactly zero. And we downloaded it overnight to millions of devices. And suddenly, and I do mean suddenly, all those standalone GPS devices were worse and more expensive than the disruptor. And so how much time in Christensen's model did you have to respond? Zero.
Well, I'm not sure that anything could actually be worse than Apple Maps, but I take your point about Google Maps. So if anything, Clayton Christensen really underestimated how dynamic the world would be and how much technological change is accelerating.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
So if anything, so his thesis, the subtitle of that book, The Innovator's Dilemma, is When New Technology Causes Great Firms to Fail. And it intrigued me so much because really, I've seen this even more play out over the last 20 years, you know, we're always obsessed with the next big corporate giant and the fear that this company has finally achieved mastery over the internet. You know, it was Prodigy and CompuServe and AOL. AOL and Friendster and MySpace and so on. And now, of course, it's Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple.
And Microsoft.
And Microsoft.
The frightful five.
One always forgets about Microsoft. And yet I take the point of your work and Christensen's work as far as it goes, even if it understates the problem, to be that those companies actually are really going to have a very hard time staying on top. Can you explain why?
Yeah, that's right. So we, and my co-author and I just had an article in the January-February issue of Harvard Business Review called Finding Your Company's Second Act. And that gets exactly to this point, which is you can, in fact, achieve tremendous market ability. I don't want to call it dominance because that has a legal meaning, but in business, it's a good thing. In law, it's a bad thing to have dominance of your market. But because of this kind of better, cheaper, faster phenomenon, if you come in with the superior GPS app, it costs nothing to distribute it. It costs nothing to get it out on all these devices. It costs very little to even create it. In many cases, you can achieve, 99% penetration and 80% market share, I'm just making numbers up, in a matter of days, if not weeks. The problem is, as you say, how long does that last? Well, in the old way of thinking, again, now on a legal firm, if you had that common dominance, it was thought that you would be able to use that dominance to keep it for a very long time. You could keep out competitors.
And maybe leverage that into a new market, right?
Leverage it and harm consumers, all the bad things that happen in the antitrust world, but because there's another generation of computing improvements coming right behind the last one. In fact, MySpace will be thrown out by Friendster. Friendster will be thrown out by Facebook. How many search engines do we go through before we got to Google? All of these companies that once seemed, all these companies that once seemed unbeatable, invariably they get beaten sooner rather than later, but often really soon.
Yeah, and let's take the example you just offered there, because you said, well, how many search engines do we go through before we got to Google? And there's a thinking there that, we're at the end of history. Finally, we've achieved the search engine, and that's going to be the search engine forever. And of course, people thought that way for a long time. And they said, well, look, Microsoft is struggling to compete with Bing, but that misses the point, right? Because you're not going to beat the incumbent by trying to do the same thing better. Right. You're going to beat the incumbent by offering Siri or Alexa, having a service where you just talk to a magical device and she talks back to you. She's a little sassy. She gives you some information. It may not be exactly the same kind of usefulness that you get from Google, but in some ways it's a lot more useful and it's getting better all the time.
Yeah. It's not that we're waiting for the next search engine. It's like, okay, we don't care about search engines anymore.
Well, we want a different way to do kind of the same thing.
Right. And we can't, and just as you have difficulty articulating it, we all have, you can't articulate what you want from a thing that you don't have yet. It's sort of like, well, why didn't you tell me that, in 50 years, if you go back to the 1950s, why didn't you tell me what you wanted were flat screen TVs with 4K resolution and remote controls on the... Because I didn't know. I didn't know because the technology obviously didn't exist. But you can't ask consumers, you can't do market research on a market that doesn't exist yet. You just have to sort of fumble your way to it. And even when you get there, whatever there is, you have to know that there's not the end. That's not the end. There's going to be new developments and consumers are going to say, oh, I love that thing. I loved it for years. Now I hate it. Give me something better.
So you know how fond I am of quoting Professor von Hayek and
Jawohl.
Yeah, and his of course he tried to become very British, but of course his bottom line was, as you said in his Nobel Prize speech, that the curious task of economics was to demonstrate to men how little they understand about what they imagine they can design. And I think he would have been very sympathetic to what you're saying. I hear you to be saying essentially that policymakers should take care not to assume that they know what the future is going to look like and try to plan it accordingly.
Yeah, I'll see your Hayek and raise you a Schumpeter because in fact, we're living in this perennial gales of creative destruction, as Schumpeter said. That's the nature of capitalism. The technologies that we've got, particularly information technologies and all sorts of things enabled by them in terms of biotech and material science, they have upped the ante of those perennial gales of creative destruction. They're faster, they're more disruptive, they are more unpredictable than they were, 150 years ago when Schumpeter first identified the phenomenon.
So again, we're in that squalid little swamp that is Washington, and people here, they can't just do nothing. They've got to do something to legislate, to regulate. Who's got to regulate, as Evan always said in this chair. So how should they think about their jobs? What sort of practical advice should they take from your work?
So look, there's a lot that regulators can do. And frankly, there's a lot that regulators do that's helpful. Obviously, you know, there's a reason why the United States has almost every single one of the most valuable internet companies in the world. And the European Union has precisely zero. The ones that aren't American are Chinese, and that's a different conversation altogether. But what has America done differently? It's not what we eat for breakfast. It's not, you know, in our sort of chemistry. It is, in fact, in our legal system that we have created a legal system that gives a lot of ground for what, our mutual friend Adam Theorer calls permissionless innovation, that allowed things like with Section 230, that allowed publishers social media and other websites to host content without being liable for it. That's certainly not the law in Europe. And why are all the social networking companies American? Because we had Section 230 to protect them from the kind of, you know, litigation that would have made it impossible to do elsewhere. So we can create a system, a capitalist foundation, if you will, of a legal system that certainly has, background protection, obviously things like antitrust, copyright, intellectual property. These are all very important to be in the background, but that we have kind of a Coasean world where we assume the market will work out most of its own problems as long as everybody knows there's somebody standing behind them with a very big stick if they don't play by the rules.
So those of you who don't follow economics very closely, so Ronald Coase, Nobel Prize winning economist, remember famously wrote about the important role that transactions costs play in shaping the world. And of course, his point was that absent transaction costs, markets would work perfectly. But of course, we don't live in a world without transaction costs. And so that's really where government does end up solving problems. But I take your point to be in general that transaction costs in general are diminishing. Mm-hmm. But it's also hard to know exactly what the solution might be or what the market structure of tomorrow will look like.
Yeah. And so that's the big picture version of it is create the system, make sure it's got checks and balances, make sure there's a regulator of last resort if things really do break and the market doesn't fix itself. But there's also things that can be done, you know, more targeted, more focused. So let's take, for example, information collection and use, or what some people call privacy. You could think about the solution here as being, well, we have some big grand privacy regime like the Europeans do, where people have all these sort of vaguely defined rights. Or you can say, you know, we're going to look and see if there are more specific problems that the market is unlikely to solve by itself. And we're going to look to see if we can design a remedy that wouldn't be worse than the problem itself, that wouldn't cost more, that wouldn't make things worse, that wouldn't have unintended consequences. So we can say, for example, yeah, when it comes to children under the age of 13, we're going to have specific rules about information collection and use. That's the American approach, if you will. And I think that's what regulators should think about is there a real problem? Can I measure it? Can I design a remedy, and is that remedy likely to be less harmful than doing nothing? And if so, regulate away.
Well, I couldn't ask for a better summary of Tech Freedom's worldview. What would you call that worldview if you had to pigeonhole yourself? Or what words do you feel comfortable using to identify your thinking about policymaking?
Oh, that's a good question. I strenuously avoid labels, as you well know. I don't have a partisan role to play here. I guess if anything, I'm an advocate for Silicon Valley. I'm an advocate for technology, principally because I think it makes life better on the whole. And in the long term, you know, we live much better lives than we did even 50 years ago. And so my general viewpoint is, let technology do as much as it can, but be on the lookout for problems that can't otherwise be solved without intervention.
Yeah, I think about this a lot. I don't really like using the word libertarian. As I get older, the more I realize that anyone that starts with rigid ideological preconceptions is probably blind to the details of the real world, and also it doesn't really capture that dynamic that you're describing, which is inherently more pragmatic, see what the facts are, and judge accordingly.
I guess pragmatic is probably the best word. I mean, I had the great honor of working for the Honorable Richard Posner after law school. And that's the way he describes himself.
Famous federal appellate judge who's written how many books?
What day is it today? It may have been a couple more.
70 or 80, as I recall.
Lots and lots of books. But he famously describes himself as a pragmatist. And I think he takes the term itself from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who apparently also called himself a pragmatist, and said, I don't have a rigid ideology. I don't have, I'm not an originalist. I don't have a lens through which I shoehorn in everything that comes before me. I get as many facts as I can. Of course, I know, information is incomplete, but I'm going to get as many facts as I can, and I'm going to try to do the thing that leads to the most efficient outcome.
But through a lens, and the lens being an assumption about the inherent dynamism of the world, right? And that's why I started out by saying that, your book really was in a way an important bookend in reading that in 2010 and getting to know you in 2009 and 2010, an important bookend to the two books I read in college, Virginia Pistrell's Future and Its Enemies, which is that great manifesto for dynamism that we've talked about on this show. We've had Virginia on, we'll link to that episode. And then Clayton Christensen's work, even as incomplete as you might see it to be, about this application of dynamism to business and what it says for policymakers. Well, that's it for this episode. Join us next time as we talk to Larry about the FCC as an example of rigid, static regulation and practice and how to fix that. Thanks for listening today. You can find this show, of course, on any podcast show of your choice. You can leave a review to help others find the show. I would encourage you not only to buy Larry's books, but also write an Amazon review for him. His books are great and they deserve the attention of other people. So again, start with The Laws of Disruption and then read Big Bang Disruption. And we'll post those. And of course, Larry's most recent article about finding your company's second act in the show notes. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.